ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the person who listened to Lisa and I in the last episode from Alabama. Welcome back to Deliver. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryant, and I have all the ideas. I have too many ideas, in fact, of things that I want to do, things that I want to start creating, and I'm going to try to start small. I'm going to start with a simple one, as is my want, and we'll see where it goes from there. I had a lot of ideas for things I want to do. I want to do more video things. If you have an idea of something I could do on a video that you might like to see, let me know, because I might throw it in the hopper and see what other things I can work on creating for everybody and for me. Some news items that I think you might be interested in. The first is from Jeff Payne, who had an article that I didn't see when it came out, but I did make it in my reading list, for why setting priorities is a core Agile practice. Something really good from Jeff, who talks about that a common root cause of failure is lack of focus. Priorities help us focus. You know what's important. You know what the most important thing is. And I think ranking those things or where your priorities come in, don't just do high, medium, low, because then everything is probably going to be high. And reprioritize things often to embrace those change. Again, you don't need to do it, and you don't want to reprioritize things every minute of the day, and probably not reprioritizing things every day. But every once in a while, reprioritize things based on what you've learned, based on what you know. That's one of those things that comes in with change and Agile. I think it's really good. And he has a good story about thinking about what is most important, how to think or when to think, and then using that to help you drive, okay, is this the most important thing we could do? Is there something else we could work on? That's really good. So thinking about priorities, or looking at priorities often, saying, are we on the right track with our priorities? Are these still our priorities? Do they help us reach our goals? Are they consistent with our values? And if not, why not? That will help you focus. Really nice short article from Jeff that I hope you check out. And the other thing that I watched this week that I really, really liked is from Savage Books, who does a lot of video essays on YouTube. I like watching a lot of YouTube. It's what I consume a lot of content on, is on YouTube through various things, various shows, things that I like. And he did a really good view on The Incredibles, talking about how it's Pixar's dark magnum opus. And I frequently like drawing parallels between film and product ownership, or directors and product ownership. I think there's a really good link that can be made there between some of the things that directors do in films and some of the things that product owners do with products. So it's a really good comparison. I like drawing those comparisons, I should say. And The Incredibles is one of my favorite movies. My intro music was heavily influenced by The Incredibles. And I just love the film. I love a lot of things about the film. I love the characters. I love the settings. I love the style, the feel of it. It really makes me happy to watch that movie. And like I said, it's one of my favorite Pixar movies. And he goes through with a really good breakdown of how the movie was created, some of the team that created the movie, some of the things that the movie did differently than other Pixar movies. He talks about the way that the creative teams have made the other Pixar movies and the way the creative team made The Incredibles, and how different that was, and all the different things, the new things that Disney allowed Pixar to do, or that Pixar did with The Incredibles that they hadn't done in other ones. And it goes and talks a lot about Brad Bird, who was the director and the writer for that. Talks about his ideas and his thoughts on the story, on the character, and about film. So you really get into a lot of details about his creative process, which I found fascinating and I thought was very interesting. And like I said, I compared a lot to some of the things that I do and have done as a product owner. And he goes through during the session, during this video, and talks a lot about visualization, talks a lot about storyboards and seeing how those storyboards connect and draw on the emotion that you want from those characters, and how things are connected, how they cut things, how they build on things, how they... there's a couple talks about different scenes where they cut a character. And to me, again, I draw parallels to cutting a feature to enhance another feature, or to talk about the different emotions that we want to bring in with some of our stories and some of these things. So I really like the sense of movies as products. And I think that's a really good parallel. Like I said, it's a little self-serving because it's one of my favorite things, and it's a really deep, nerdy dive into it. And I hope if you check it out, you see some parallels there as well. And one more thing that I made note of on Twitter, retweeted somebody, Cindy Alvarez had a really good tweet that I kind of want to throw in here just as a reminder of things. She says, when customers ask for a feature, there are two obviously wrong ways to respond. No, we're not going to build that. And yes, we'll put it on the roadmap.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
Let me ask you a question. Are you biased? Do you have any biases? If you said no, then I'd like to learn how you did that. There are so many cognitive biases that exist that it's very likely you apply multiple and then at least some biases every day. There are some biases you're aware of and others you aren't, at least not yet. Let's talk about some of the biases that product owners need to be aware of, look out for, and how to counteract them. I have no problem admitting that, yes, I am biased on several things, some of them for my betterment, some at my own peril, some known sometimes and unknown with others. The reason I know I'm under a bias at various points for different reasons is because there are so flippin' many of them to begin with. New ones are being identified quite frequently as well. So if you don't think you have one now, just wait a bit and some smart chap will likely identify it for you. There's a very cool image of over 175 cognitive biases that I will link to, and that shows that quite well. To start with the basics of cognitive biases, it's a way for we humans to increase our ability to process and think about the thousands of things that we do every day. Biases are necessary to help us shortcut and make quick decisions and choices. It's a way that we train ourselves to make mental shortcuts. Sometimes, depending on what we're doing, that bias could make an error in our judgment or thinking. That's where we get into trouble by not understanding our biases and how they can be recognized, admitted, and countered. Sometimes biases are known by other names, and more than a few of the identified biases have this other name, a heuristic, a fallible way of solving a problem. It might be wrong sometimes, most of the times, it's correct enough. That term heuristic is something I learned long ago in my testing days from Michael Bolton at a testing conference, and it still makes sense to me. I've read and listened to several people discussing behavioral economics and psychology mention thinking fast and slow from Kahneman and Tversky. This applies very well because bias and heuristics help us with system one thinking, the automatic pilot mode we often find ourselves in. They hurt us when we're in system two thinking or using rational thought, logic, and deliberation. Not only are heuristics another name for them, they might also be some of the more popular effects, laws, fallacies, and many other terms that are all considered cognitive biases. Product folks, which should you look out for then? The one that most people point to is the confirmation bias, the idea that we agree and look for things that we already thought and are looking for ways to back that up. Information that doesn't help our cause, we dismiss. This is bad, of course, for multiple reasons, the primary one, in my mind, being that it doesn't help us be curious. If we're looking for data about a product idea or want to see how something is performing, we should look at all the data and see what it says. Having our initial hypothesis is great because now we know what kinds of things could help or hurt that hypothesis. If we only look at information that supports our idea and not at things that run counter to it, then we risk and should look like a fool. I've seen this so many times in companies and teams where information that didn't fit the plan or the narrative or any other decision was dismissed as irrelevant when it clearly was not. There are a ton of other related biases to confirmation. The actor-observer bias is one where we tend to make up stories, excuses, or reasons why we did something. It's not my fault I was speeding. I was trying to get to work on time versus the other person's. Why was that idiot going so fast? I bet he's drunk. We excuse our actions by externalizing the problem and others by internalizing it. Our team did the best they could under the circumstances. How many times have you heard that in a retro? It was the other team that made us miss our deadline, is something I've heard a number of times. Very similar to the self-serving bias, the idea that the success was all us, the failure was someone else, not me or our team. To combat these very primary biases, I'd like to ask myself, what if the opposite is true? Or I've been on some great teams with people who thought and experienced things differently than I did. When I would feel comfortable, a bit too comfortable, I'd ask, what is missing here? The phrase I'm going to start using from David Marquet is, who sees this differently? Pulling those other views, the other side of an argument, idea, or data is important to keep yourself out of a bias danger zone. Your instinct, your data, or your idea might be correct. Let's test it out, see if it holds up. Another one I see an awful lot is the anchoring bias, the idea that the first number you hear, people latch onto that for some reason. Doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. It's a company saying their new phone would retail for $1,000, but surprise, it's on sale for $800. Wow, what a deal. If they came out and said the phone was $800, would you feel like you were getting a good price? This happens so often with dates and estimations with teams. Someone in a discovery session, especially a senior technical person, might estimate a story very low. Everyone else is influenced by that number and conforms around it. Very few people will disagree with them. People in the hierarchy, managers, or something else might say something like, I could do that in 2 days. Now what? The team thinks they're stuck to that number sometimes and tries to make it work, which will fail. Another prevalent example is saying that something might be done in 3 to 4 sprints based on our current forecasts. Even if you deliver working software for those 3 to 4 sprints, if you do something more, new or not, in the 5th sprint, the heavens crash down around you. You said it's only going to be 3 sprints. Here you are working it for 5 now. That person doesn't understand agility, iterative and incremental delivery, or that we are constantly learning as we go. They are only anchored to a date of timeline without regard to other things. One practice that I put in place for me and advice for other senior people, don't give a number. Just don't. Not an opinion, not an experience, not a thought. Just shut up. Let the team, the customers, and the clients talk first and listen to them. Understand if they are bringing up things that are missing parts of the puzzle that you have. After you listen to them, you can ask good questions or fill in bits of information that might be missing. Resist all urges or demands for dates and hard numbers. If you do have to give them something, give them a range. Give them a confidence number. Make it obvious that it's a guess or a bet. Don't let them drown you with their anchoring bias. There's a story that I've seen a couple times in conferences that talks about the survivability or survivorship bias. It's an example from World War II, and it shows a picture of an Allied airplane, likely a bomber, returning after a run. It had taken anti-aircraft fire, and several surfaces and areas of the planes were riddled with damage. Holes clean through wings, or even parts torn off from the control surfaces. Initially, the story goes, the military looked at the damage and wanted to reinforce those areas. The thinking was much along the lines of, we see where the damage is happening, and we want to prevent having that much damage in the future. Then a mathematician made a note of saying that all the damages on all the planes that they were looking at and suggesting to beef up were all the ones that made it home. The armor they wanted to add would be better spent reinforcing the areas that had no dots in it at all. Those were the areas that meant if they were hit, the plane wouldn't survive the encounter. Think about that. The focus on things that lived through an event were telling you the opposite of what your initial thought is. How many customers do you look at for metrics? How many made it through the sign-up process? How many success or completion KPIs are you tracking? Imagine the goal of increasing sign-ups by 5%. You may even hit that number by experimenting and delivering. How many did you lose in the sign-up process, though? How many started the sign-up and didn't finish it? Imagine running a test where you had 50% of new users sign in and 5% finished. Do you still feel good about hitting your OKR? Where did the others fall out? What could you do about that? Only looking at the success number doesn't tell you the full story. Look for the things that didn't show up and understand why. Some other related biases here are the appeal to probability fallacy, the idea that something might happen or could happen. Therefore, we should do something to prevent it or account for it. I see a lot of developers, POs, and stakeholders fall deep into this one. Some customer we might have in the future would really want to do this. Really? Is this a customer we have now? Do we have this problem now? Is this future-proofing, gold-plating, doing unnecessary work for an uncertain future? Don't do that. Build what you need for the customers you have now and their problems. Concern yourself about other things when they present themselves. Something I learned while doing my research is that there is a bias called the magic number 7 plus or minus two. I always thought this was something that was a correct answer for what's the best team size or what's the likely number of stories a team could do in a sprint. Maybe the number of teams in a product or program. Turns out this is a psychology paper from 1956 that was talking about the number of items the average human can hold in short-term memory, often called Miller's Law. That is an example of an unknown to me bias. What about if you're looking at a team's velocity over the last 10 sprints, and one sprint was well above the others, or a product traffic one particular day was well above the average for a Tuesday? What happened? How likely are you and others to remember those outliers? That's the bizarreness effect. Or when looking at groups of things and remembering the one that's different over remembering the other like objects, that's the isolation effect, useful when looking at data. I see teams and managers suffering from the IKEA effect a lot. Because they spend a lot of time on that story, or that code, or that career path, they value it more because they worked on it. It's personal. They have invested part of their worth into that thing. It's very similar to when a stakeholder, or product owner, or customer suffers from the endowment effect. There's a sense of ownership that causes us to value something more than if we never owned it at all. How many times have you seen a stakeholder with an idea that they kept bringing up to a planning session, only to see it ranked as the 37th most important capability we could do this quarter? How hard do they fight every time instead of looking at the bigger picture with the product and the customers? It's very important to them. Further down that same road, people face the loss aversion bias when they perceive a loss having a greater impact than an equal amount of gain. Imagine a team where at some point during an iteration, we had to cut a 5-point story. How do people react to that? Imagine if we were able to pull in a 5-point story during the sprint. How do they react to that situation? Which one of those two do you think would be remembered more? Which one would you talk about more? How dare you take away work from the team? What about if a customer is used to a certain navigation pattern or workflow in our applications, and we change it for the better? Now they have to learn the new pattern, the keystrokes or options that they had memorized. Some complain loudly. Which do they remember 6 months from now? One of my biases that I revel in is the frequency illusion or the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon, the notion that once you notice something, you see it everywhere. It's very common when you get a new car or item, suddenly that item starts showing up everywhere now. It likely didn't. You're just more aware of it now, so it seems more common. I do this with waste, queues, lines, delays, dependencies in systems, and more. Once I start seeing it, I can't unsee it. At that point, I believe others should see it too. I'm biased that way. Sometimes they do, or it might take years or months. Others that POs and teams will run headfirst into, especially in organizations and situations new to agility, when we continue down the path we had originally committed to because we think we make good decisions or we feel the need to defend them, that's the commitment bias, sometimes known as the irrational escalation or the escalation of commitment. When this happens, one way out is to show that the past behavior or thinking no longer aligns with the value or the goal. Growth should be encouraged and allowed. I've worked with several teams, and we've mentioned with guests on the show before how some people suffer from the not invented here syndrome. Because we didn't build it, come up with it, or it's from outside, we can't use it here. We have to roll our own security. We can't use that open source or widely adopted one. We can't use Scrum as is. We have to change all the titles. And we'll only do half of it, and we'll call them different things. Amazing to me when this runs in the safe again, as that seems to be taken at face value by a lot of folks. That shows their cognitive dissonance. They can't deal with anything uncomfortable, and that looks comfortable to them. Whereas myself and others are biased against it, based on our experience and very likely applying the halo effect to it. Sometimes we counter that by saying parts of a thing are good. Very common, I hear with SAFE and some Scrum things as well. I could go on. There are so many. I won't, however. But do tell me which bias you think you use a lot in both a positive and a negative sense. I won't say that biases are bad either. They're helpful in situations. You just have to be aware of them. They do help us in four areas. When we have too much information, when there's a lack of meaning, when we need to react fast, and when we need to know what to remember later. Our ways of shortcutting all the decisions and problems we face are based on our experience and our values. There are trade-offs that we make for things and ways we rationalize our thinking. If it's important, be aware of how we make those decisions and look for ways to challenge yourself and others. Look for your bias blind spot. It's closer than it appears. Don't fall prey to the hindsight bias when evaluating product or team decisions. And whatever you do, keep striving for better. Don't let the status quo bias put its flag near your space, or things likely won't change. I'll end this with a clip of a song I heard many years ago that I quite like from Brad Ray. He wrote a song for his psychology students about some biases. It's quite catchy.
I'm biased because I think my opinion now was my opinion then. Self-consistency bias, but you felt different way back when. Oh, bias, don't let bias into your mind. Bias, don't try this, it'll influence your thinking and memories. Don't mess with these, guilty of distorted thinking. Cognitive bias, man becomes blinded. Decisions and problems, you've been forced to solve them all.
For any feedback or questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at Deliverkast or email us at deliverkast@gmail.com. Please share the show around with friends or coworkers, subscribe, and help us reach more folks. A couple questions that I thought were interesting. One from Boris, who asked, how do you measure product agility? For me, the main benefit of Agile is that you should and can be able to adjust your direction fast. How to make sure the product is flexible enough, technical and architecture-wise, to accommodate an agile mindset. Okay, product agility, how do you measure it? I think a primary question is, how fast can you make a change and get that change in the hands of a customer? Any change. Ron Jeffries has a really good example about changing the wording on your login screen in your application. How long would it take you to change that and get that in front of a customer? I would say if that takes you more than a month, your product agility is very poor. If you could make that change in about 5 minutes, I'd say your product agility is excellent. And that's a simple example. There are probably more examples that you would say, well, we can't change complete things. Like we can't change a API without it breaking. That will take time. That'll take a couple iterations. If so, again, that's okay. I would say for the majority of things that you're doing, let's say 60%, how quickly can you build and can you deploy them based on information that you have today, not on information you had last month, last quarter, or whatever. If you had to make a change today, how long would it take you to get that change in? Look at a couple different scenarios. Look at simple things like the login. Look at more complicated things like an architecture change or an upgrade. Look at medium-based things like new features, capabilities, or something like that that build on existing things and see how long it would take you to build, deploy, and deliver to a customer to get them to use each of those things. Measure it. Measure how people are using things. I think that's important for product agility too. But that would be my starting question at least, Boris. Hope that helps. Then I'm going to pull in a question from Dan from the Agile Moose Herd that we were talking about the other day that I thought was relevant to an episode we did. Dan asked a very simple question, what is a platform? He has his own idea about what a platform is, but he's never heard the term defined, and he's a little uneasy when talking to people about the platform because he's not really sure we're talking about the same thing. I related this a little bit to what Todd and I talked about in episode 104, which is product definition, defining product. I'm not sure if there's quite that big of a difference between products as platforms. What I finally said was I'm fine with the definition of a platform as one or more products that share a common set of standards, practices, interfaces for working together as parts of a whole. We see this in multiple places. The Word example, Word, Excel, those are platforms. We see it with Google. We see it with other applications. The ecosystem that is Apple has its own platform, the iTunes and all the apps that get there. Those things share common things. They also don't share other things as well. But I think it's that commonality, standards, practices, interfaces for different products, I think that is the definition of a platform. At least that's what I was able to come up with and what I agree with. So if you have thoughts about your platform or how you would define it, please let me know. That's it for today. Next couple episodes, we will have guests. Today, I wanted to do a little exploration on an idea and a concept that I wanted to learn more about. I thought I had some ideas, and I wanted to kind of share those with everybody. So I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget that if you'd like any one-to-one coaching, product consulting, or organizational agility help, I do offer that over at seektaiju.com. All opinions expressed here are mine. Find more of them is Corey Bryant on Twitter. That is episode 114, delivered, go out, and own the outcome.
Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.